Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Sue Miller, author of Monogamy, published this month by Harper. Sue's written 10 novels. You all remember The Good Mother, of course, all bestsellers, including Family Pictures, While I Was Gone, The Senator's Wife, and The Arsonist. Her The Story of My Father, a memoir, meshes to a certain extent with the subject matter of monogamy. Oh, yeah, and Inventing the Abbots, which I really liked and was a great movie with Liv Tyler. So monogamy is about Graham and Annie, their marriage, their happiness, and the emptiness that sometimes accompanies that relationship. So we think we know each other, we think we know our partners, and many times we do, and many times we don't in the slightest. In monogamy, Annie knows Graham intimately in all senses of the word, at least while he's there. After, things change, and that is what this book focuses on. How sometimes things dangle, they adhere, they create misery, doubt, and double grief. In all, monogamy reminds us of ourselves, and in these strange times that we live in, how certainty can oftentimes become its opposite. We can all be widows. Welcome, Sue, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
Tell us a little bit about your book.
It's really a character-based book completely, I think. And that was a lot of my concern and why it took me so long to write. But I just really wanted you to know these people very, very well. So it's about a marriage, the long-term marriage between Annie and Graham, both of whom have had previous marriages. They're very devoted to each other. He's big, as we've discussed, big in spirit, big in his body. One time, and she's very small. One time they went to a party together as, you know, Santa Claus and one of his elves. And he's very outgoing and very just embraces everybody, sort of drags everybody in, essentially. And Annie's very much the opposite, in fact. She's very, she's not reserved exactly, but she's private. And so they, in some ways, they make a very odd couple, but in some ways they work very well together. And the book, after Graham's death, the book sort of opens out slowly. In the first part of the book, you're with Annie and you're with Graham separately, and then you're with them when they're together. And you sort of have a grasp of each person's character and of the nature of the marriage. You see them interacting. And then Graham dies, and Annie, in the hours after his death, has to begin to call people. And then the book widens out to include those people that she's called. First of all, she calls her daughter, who's on the West Coast. She has to wait a little while to call her because of the time difference. And she talks to her, and then I actually take up Sarah for a while. Sarah's the daughter. And after Annie hangs up, we jump over and we're with Sarah. And then Annie calls Frieda, the first wife. She thinks briefly of calling Lucas, Frieda's son with Graham, because she's very close to him, but she realizes that would be a mistake, that Frieda should be the one to tell Lucas. So in a certain way, that's emblematic of the sort of delicacy and the care with which people treat each other in this family. There's kind of a, in some ways, a little bit of awkwardness sometimes, given the sort of cross affiliations there have been and so forth. She calls Frieda, and I stop and talk about Frieda for a while, and Frieda then calls Lucas, her son. So the word goes out, essentially, and then I begin to move around among those characters after those phone calls to see really how it affects each one, to sort of look at the nature of grieving that each one launches into. I come back to Annie and her really overwhelming sorrow and grief, and the way in which she wants to hold on to the grief, essentially, as a connection with him. That's part of not wanting to give him up in some ways, to go on grieving for him. And after a few months of this, of Annie's grief and then getting used to it, they have a memorial party, essentially, for Graham at the bookstore and then afterwards at Annie and Graham's house. And at some point in this party, Annie goes upstairs and finds a woman sort of mourning in Graham's study. And the woman looks up at her, and there's this change from sorrow to real guilt, essentially, an apology. And Annie realizes that that there's been some connection between them, that he's undoubtedly been having an affair with this woman. That's as much as she ever knows for sure, actually, except, ironically, it gets confirmed by Frieda, who's confirming the wrong affair, essentially. But then Annie's grief becomes this, is just transformed. I mean, she's enraged, and she's enraged at her grieving to him. She's so furious at him, she actually says to Frieda that she'd like him back so she could hit him. And then another point, she said she'd like him back so she could kill him. And the part of the difficulty of this is, of course, she can't act that way in front of anybody. She has to keep pretending that she is in this kind of pure, lovely grief instead of this enraged grief. I guess you can still call it grief. And then basically we sort of move along with everybody's lives and the nature of their moving away from grieving him. And Annie all the while is just really tormented by this. And we take up life several years later, finally, and watch Annie moving around in her grief and learning things by events that happened to her, I think. It's kind of book ends with a sort of revelation, I suppose you could say.
Yeah, it's funny because it's almost like you could have called the book Grief Interrupted, like Girl Interrupted.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. That would have been a good title. Except somebody already basically used it, but yeah.
Right, true.
Yeah.
But, you know, the funny thing is, you know, you mentioned Elizabeth Kubler-Ross in the book, mm-hmm. and it's become kind of like a cliche, the stages of grief. Mm-hmm. But as I just said, she reaches a certain stage, and then because of this illumination, the grief process stops.
Yeah.
And that may be the whole idea of the book. And if it isn't for... Well, that's the other thing that's interesting, is that... And this is kind of like the way I am with my first wife, and neither of my wives would mind me saying this, but I'm better friends with my first wife than I was when we were mm-hmm. married. Mm-hmm. And Graham uses Frieda as this confidant.
Yeah. But he has told her about a previous affair, which is why Frieda confirms an affair. She doesn't know about the one Annie's talking about, but she, anyway, and some of that was just really interesting and fun to write, this sort of working at cross purposes that people do several times in the book where they misunderstand each other. And it's disastrous, actually, a little bit for Frieda and Annie's relationship for a while. So Annie's outraged.
There's so many different ways of looking at this, because like Frieda, for example, she is a sympathetic character, but you've made her so multidimensional that there's a part of her that, I don't know, maybe it's just me, there's a part of her that I kind of don't like. Mm-hmm. And it's referenced literally when she's not invited to the scattering of Graham's ashes. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was
interesting. That's by the wish of her son with Graham, that he just is, his relationship with her is very complicated. He feels excluded a little because he lives nearby with Frieda and Annie and Graham, you know, he's often over at their house and Sarah is there. And he just is angry at Frieda for having lost his father for him, essentially. And he's very critical of her. Everything wrong you could see about Frieda, Lucas notices. And a little bit priggish, maybe a little bit self-righteous. There's one point in which he wants to go to a party, and she won't let him go unless she can talk to the parents of the girl giving the party. These are teenagers we're talking about. And he says, and he just can't stand that. He says, you can't do that. That, you know, essentially embarrass me that way. And she says, well, then you can't go. And he's just so furious at her. And especially the way he says, nobody else's parents are doing this and care about this. And she says, well, I do. And that just pisses him off so much. And that is sort of the way he perceives her, is this person who's an impediment to his life. And he actually draws much closer to Annie in those years as a result.
Not to say. It's like Annie is much closer to, Lucas is much closer to Annie.
Exactly. Yeah. Because he objects to Frida. He just isn't, and he doesn't get over that really. And he really doesn't. So he's the person who, in this sort of little bit of a mess around the scattering of the ashes, he's the person who really does not want her there at the scattering of the ashes. He wants to feel easily connected to his father and not have this complication of the way he feels about his mother.
Even the complication of telling her, of them getting together and figuring out who's going to tell her, and Annie feeling horrible, but at the same time, she didn't want. Yeah, that's really good, because once again, the sign of a good book is the reader's thinking, well, what would I do? Is this right? Shouldn't she be there? All those questions like kind of move around in your head. And it's funny, too, because the other side of the coin is that Sarah, whose body image, for right or for wrong, is not good, she's much closer to her father than she is with Annie. He's the one who comforts her.
Yeah. And she says about Annie, Sarah does, she's right after she's heard the news, she's sort of numb a little bit, and she's talking to a new lover, actually, which is sort of a surprise. I hoped it would be a surprise for the reader, because Annie, through whose eyes we've seen Sarah, sees her as kind of this dumpy loser, essentially. I mean, she loves her in a certain way. Of course she does, but Sarah's just been very complicated for her to have as a daughter and very resentful of her. But at any rate, when she's talking to Thomas, he asks about her parents, essentially. And, you know, he doesn't know her very well, and they've just become lovers. And now he's talking to her just as she's heard that her father has died. But he asks about her parents. And essentially she said, when something goes wrong, her mother wants to resolve it. You know, let's do this. We got to fix this. And so she can't dwell with you in your sorrow, whereas her father could. I mean, she says it's as though he knew that some things are just not fixable in life. Some things are just going to be sad. And she says that he was able to sit with her in her sorrow and not try to resolve it. And she says perhaps because of what was hard in his own life, it's hard growing up. And they talk about that too. And that's where you sort of, you learn more about Graham's growing up there. You learn some at the beginning too, but anyway, very different, those two. And Graham was just of central importance to Sarah.
I like Tommy. He was a nice guy, wasn't he?
Yes, he was, yeah.
Yeah, and yeah, you didn't expect him in there, but that also gives you a little bit of perspective. You know, this is a guy that, I don't know whether she just met him. We don't know how long the relationship's gone. It's relatively new, of course.
Yes, it is.
But he's very comforting, and he's a very good person, kind of like a stabilizing aspect, even though he's only there for a little bit. We're not with him for a long time.
Right.
The other thing is that some of the reviews, which I totally disagreed with this point, act as if Annie's like this really shy, introverted person. And I don't see her that way at all. I mean, especially when she's having casual sex after her first marriage, and then when she throws the glass of wine on Graham, that seems like somebody who's kind of like cool and outgoing and funny. And so I don't
think she's not outgoing, but she is funny. But she's self-contained. I don't think she's shy at all, not at all. But she just doesn't open up to people easily. I mean, she can look around, but sort of her self is very sort of private and held away, but she's very sociable. She's easily sociable. She's not a hermit by any means.
Yeah, it's funny too, because me owning my independent bookstore, which this background's horrible for, because all it is light bulbs, but I didn't feel like moving the computer to make it look cool. Owning an independent bookstore, I have the luxury of being able to do it since I practiced law for 40 years. Mm-hmm. But you can't make a lot of money. I don't care what people say. And with her peripatetic photography income, I wondered about, well, two things. I wondered about how long they'd been together. Because at first you don't get the idea that they're older, perhaps like in their early 60s, late 50s.
Yeah, about that age, yeah.
Yes,
mathematically figured out, but I don't remember it that well.
Well, I just read it. So they're of that certain age, and you don't get it at first. You just kind of, there is no age. It's just their mm-hmm. relationship. But it goes mm-hmm. on for a very long time. And I always wondered, okay, are they doing well? Are they well-to-do? I mean, he loves his bookstore like I do. It's his passion. Mm-hmm. And he has all these great authors there, and he knows so many people, and they have great get-togethers, and he has great employees. But it's tough. I would think it would be tough for them to get along economically.
It is. I mean, they don't, I mean, their house is just this sort of really small little former coach house, and it's pretty shabby. We don't really know that for a while. There was some review that called them this golden couple, and I was thinking, well, they're sort of scraping along, really, essentially. And that comes up a couple of times. I mean, Sarah has, after her father dies, she sort of is trying to figure out actually whether there is any money. And there really isn't. I mean, there's some, he left a life insurance policy, but the bookstore is he owns with someone else who's the money person, essentially, and he runs it. So there's some money, but not, it's just not a lot by any means. I mean, I think they're making it barely.
It's interesting. There's tons of bookstores in Philadelphia, and there's one downtown called the Book Trader. And if I didn't have all the people around me and all the things I had to do, he's there like from 8 o'clock in the morning till 7 or 8 o'clock at night with his cat. And that would be, you know, I really would like that. I would like to do that because you meet so many interesting people, you make so many friends, and you're with books. Mm-hmm. And they just had this documentary about books where they're sitting around the table and one of the guys goes, "Why would you do anything else?" Yeah. And I thought about it, and there's something to that. I mean,
oh no, it's a great, in some ways, it's just a great, great life, I think. I had an earlier novel in which there was a character who owns a bookstore. Her husband has money, essentially, and he helps her buy this bookstore. And in order to sort of do some, I mean, not that I haven't spent a lot of time in bookstores, but in order to write about it, I spent some time talking to and then working for a few days in a bookstore in Sonoma, California. And it was almost as I had imagined it. I think they were more worried about money than I had imagined it in that particular instance, the earlier book. But they're worried about money here to some degree. But Peter is there as his partner just has dough. And nobody kind of knows where it comes from, but he just is fine with it, so which is very nice, sort of magical element in the book, perhaps.
Well, literally, I guess everything's literal. Literally, he is a silent partner.
Because mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
He has nothing to do with the running of the store.
No, not at all.
He's a friend. Yeah.
What was I going to ask you? I just wrote it down. Oh, I know. Graham's friend who meets him at the bar.
John.
Yeah. Yeah. He foreshadows the whole book when he says to her, "He loved you. He loved you so much. Remember that no matter what happens."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And she wonders then, what does he mean?
Yeah, and what an odd thing to say. Really, she's scared.
Yeah. And again, if you didn't know, you would go, "I wonder what the heck he means by that."
If you didn't know exactly what he means, yeah. Because you've been around and heard Graham talk to him about it and heard his take on Graham as someone who has trouble with women, essentially. And so you're very aware of his perspective on it, for one thing, and then you're aware of why he's saying it. And as though for you, it's not foreshadowing anything. I mean, I think you know what he's saying and you know what he means, and it just confirms it in some way.
One of the things you've said in the past, unless I got it wrong, and it's what I do when I write too, and it reminds me of James Joyce's Ulysses, the Nighttown episode, when basically what he's doing is just writing down what he hears people saying at the bar. Mm-hmm. And I've done that before, and it sounds like you do that too. I'm not saying you write it down, but you listen to people, and then you hear them, and people are interesting. And their dialogue is interesting.
Some people are interesting.
Okay, so.
I become more and more convinced that not all people are interesting.
If you go out and listen to people talking, it may not be good, but it's telling, and it is dialogue that seems natural. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you have incorporated some of that in your works, haven't you?
I don't make notes ever. There's a wonderful line of Henry James, you know, be somebody on whom nothing is lost. And I sort of feel that I am very attentive to other people in that way, but not in a way that sort of hoards it for the books, but it's there when I need it. I have a good memory, I guess, in that case, of certain ways of behaving and even certain specific things that people have said that are just there because I have it. But I don't make notes about anything unless I'm making notes about a book, a specific book. But I'm not someone who has a notebook that I take around, although I know that's often advice given to people who are beginning to write it, you know, make notes. And I think, you know, it may be helpful. I just have never done it. I've never had a journal. I mean, there are a lot of things that you're supposed to do that just haven't ever interested me, I guess.
Yeah, well, it's good not to do the things you're supposed to do. I've always found that. Well, actually, it hasn't always worked out, but yeah. and that begs the question, which is perhaps a Terry Gross question. Is Graham based on anybody, or is he an amalgamation of anybody that you're familiar with?
Because a couple of friends that he is connected to, but his, but just in terms of outer elements of his life, he is an invention in terms of what he says, his embrace of life, those kinds of things are invented. Those are not true of any particular, I mean, they're true of a lot of people, but they're sort of a general sense I have of what I wanted to make him. And, you know, I did use some details. I mean, it's sort of like, I mean, you know, you sort of think of someone's voice and you think of someone you know, and then you have the voice, you know, think of the way their voice is sort of scratchy or very fluid or, you know, that kind of thing. Then his smile, you know, Lucas's smile. I mean, there are just things like that that may come from somewhere. But for the most part, I think Graham was invention, just invention, yeah.
And with regard to Annie, and I know you said, you know, she's diminutive. Anybody would be compared to Graham. But I can't tell whether she's really pretty or not pretty. Mm-hmm. You don't really give that away.
Well, he finds her very elegant looking and he, you know, she's very, I describe her, but yeah, he finds her lovely. But it's a matter of coloring and her eyes. And he also finds her just from the moment he sets eyes on her.
That's what I was going to say.
Very compelling and sexually very, very compelling indeed to him.
That reminds me then. So yeah, if you look at his appetites sexually and otherwise, and what Frieda knows, the reason they got divorced, is what he did so important that Annie holds on to it as long as she does? Is it really that crucial with regard to their relationship that his death without telling her and without her knowing is so, so important to her?
It is for a number of reasons. For one, there's no way to work it out. There's no way to talk about it with him. I mean, it might have been that had she been able to just turn to him and hit him, as she says she would like to do, and then, you know, eventually talk to him, I think it might not have been as important. And I think through talking to herself in a certain way and imagining him, she gets to that point, actually. But I think that one of the things she thinks about is the fact that he and Frieda had an open marriage.
Right.
And when, so that they had this, you know, but Frieda consented to it. He talked to Frieda about it. And they agreed that they would do this thing. That feels very different to Annie. Just her not knowing, I think, is a big, huge part of it, and the fact that she's never going to be able to discuss it with him and find any resolution out there at all. And I think that is, I think that's a large part of it, actually, just that he's already not able to talk to her about it.
They wouldn't have broken up. At least,
I mean, I think she would have been furious, but I don't think they would have separated or anything. I just don't think so.
The other thing, and I don't even know if this is a spoiler, so you can stop me or I can edit it out, but, you know, he felt really bad.
He did. He felt awful. Yeah.
But then, and again, if I hadn't known, I was so happy that he was happy when he broke it off, that that night of it all, it was like this great weight had been lifted off of him.
Yeah. And he's actually a little ashamed of that, because it happens very quickly after he has finished breaking off the relationship with Rosemary, that he doesn't feel bad about it for long enough, he feels. I mean, he is a person who judges himself pretty harshly, I think. I mean, he's not someone who moves around carelessly. He is a little careless, but he's aware of that in himself. He's aware that he asks a lot of other people, and he's aware that he needs too much from other people. And I think I liked him enormously as a character. I liked everybody in this book. And it's a good thing, because it took me 6 years to write it. So it's good that I, could stand to be around them for that long. And I could. I just really liked making them and thinking of them.
Yeah, there are no villains. There really aren't any villains.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure there are some people who would read Graham as a villain, and that's...
No, I don't think so. I mean, yes, he had enormous appetite. You know what it is? It's that it's not really sadder but wiser, but there are certain people that, especially in our times right now, that have no perspective. So because of that, they can't really listen. So that's why we're so polarized. But if you have perspective, as Graham does, and you can step outside of your actions to observe them, it's kind of like sadder but wiser. It would be better. You would not have as good a moral. That's an interesting question. Is he more moral because he can look at what he's done, or is he less moral because he looks at what he's done and still does it?
I have no idea. I mean, that seems to me the way people might feel very differently about that. I mean, and I think, in part, I sort of answer that question by Annie's final conclusions, I think, about herself, amongst other things, and then about Graham. I mean, she's comparing their sense of morality at the very end of the book.
Yeah, and to conclude with, I guess, and this I will not spoil, is that the last few lines of the book encapsulate what you just said. It gives the reader, again, although, you know, some people like their books kind of boxed up in the end with paper around, wrapped up with a ribbon. You don't do that. You don't do it on a lot of your books.
That to me is sort of one of the interesting things, is to sort of leave the reader to make up his own mind about all of the things that have happened beforehand.
It's not the kind of feeling where you expect a sequel or something silly like that. It's just that
People have asked me, about The Good Mother, if I don't feel like writing a sequel. And I'm done with those people. I wrote the book. That's enough.
Yeah.
And they don't bother me after that. I mean, I think, I expect people to be able to live. You know, I sort of have lectured on this occasionally about the unresolved book and the way in which that's adult reading, essentially, not to need everything to be resolved. And I was thinking of Stuart Little. I don't know if you remember it, but, sure. You know, this was the first book I read as a child, or actually I had it read to me by my father, that didn't end up, tied up nicely with a bow and everything. And I just remember as, you know, Stuart drives off into the sunset, and we don't know if he's going to find Margalo, this bird he's driving off to find. We don't know anything about what's going to happen to him. And it was the first time I sort of thought of, first of all, I was just shocked. I mean, that the book could possibly end that way. And then it was the first time I was aware that someone was writing this book and had chosen to make it end that way. I mean, I'd always thought of stories as just being they sort of arrive, you know, and that's that. I mean, I'd never thought of them as being constructed by somebody. You know, I just like, starting with fairy tales, once upon a time. I mean, you just sort of know the way they're going to go, and that's good. And they end the way you expect them to end, happily ever after, and that's good. And here was a story, a book that didn't end that way and ended in a way that was just bizarre to me as a child. But I was aware that someone had decided to end it this way, finally, that there was a writer behind it instead of just this received stuff.
Pretty cool.
I think it's the first time that I sort of thought of writing in a certain way.
That's what I was going to ask you. How old were you?
I suspect I was probably 7 or 8. Must have been about then. Yeah.
So after you read it, you thought, oh, this can be done. Did you think that?
Yeah, I sort of, I mean, not in any, you know, clear way, right. But I think that was an awareness I had that, you know, that it could be done, and it was done willfully by somebody. Somebody chose it. You could choose it. You could choose the way a story would come out. You could choose who the people were going to be in it and that sort of thing. I mean, I always was writing myself at that stage. I sort of wrote little poems and stuff for my parents. But, you know, I wrote a lot. I wrote, you know, and I won a high school, you know, National Scholastic Award, which is a big deal. It's a nationwide award, and there's a long history of very distinguished American writers who've won these at 15 or 16 or so. And I wasn't aware of that. It's being very distinguished at the time that I actually did win it. But, you know, I was always writing. But I think some of it had to do just with always reading so much as I read. I mean,
The interesting part of this story, which also could kind of be a book, is that this is a moment, you know, you have these moments of epiphany. And this,
but I wasn't aware of it. I mean, it sort of was just there. I mean, I didn't go, oh my God. I mean, I had no, it's odd. I mean, it was just there suddenly. I mean, it just was kind of something I would say I slowly realized it over some long period of time, but I realized it. I mean, my first feeling was just that this was weird and of disappointment that I wasn't ever going to know this, whether he finds her or not. Of course, that was the whole point of the book for me. Whereas I think E.B. White had other things in mind.
And now you've decided to follow that path. And I think as a reader and as the owner of a bookstore where I hear people say, well, what is she going to do? And at book clubs, especially, at book clubs, people go, well, why would she end it like that?
Because she read Stuart Little when she was little.
So, okay, we'll end it at that. And I'll do my Terry Gross thing. So we've been talking today with Sue Miller regarding her new book, Monogamy, which has just been released by Harper. And thank you so much for joining us. I really enjoyed it, especially the part about Stuart Little.
I enjoyed it too. I'm glad to bring Stuart Little up whenever I can. I spend my life thinking, could I insert him here?
That's a laudable goal.
Thanks.
Okay, we'll talk to you next time.
Great. I hope there is one, you know.
There will be. Okay,
bye-bye. Thanks so much. Bye.